slam it? Do you know how to ram it? Oh, please just ram it.
Then he really gets into it.
Do you know how to ram it? We will be rocking in LA, so let's ram it today. Just ram it.
Yes.
We are gonna do ram it. Just
yeah, ram
that's
it.
Where he just rammed it.
Everybody ram it. We'll be rocking in LA. Say hello to the Rams today and ram it.
I mean, now he's like on his feet.
Ram it.
Wow.
Ram it.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Rams Brothers, the pod. I'm your host, Dean, and I'm joined by my brother and the other host of this show, Nick. And Nick's got his Ram shirts on, his best man shirt on. He's ready to go. Nick, how are you tonight?
Good, Dean. How you doing?
I'm hanging in there. We have a lot on the slate tonight. I think we're both jonesing for some football. I know you are.
Yeah, I mean, luckily it's our last month without football in the year. We get some preseason next month. And then September, right into it. And I'm excited to go to SoFi and watch these games with you.
I know it's starting to drive me crazy that football's not right around the corner, but it is. It's 2 weeks away until training camp. Then we're ready to go. We're going to talk about today McVay and Shanahan and the Flying Coach, Peter Schrager's podcast, where McVay is the co-host, a preview of training camp. So a deep dive into what we expect from McVay's offense this year, which is long overdue from us. I think the Kurt Warner movie. So American Underdog from Lionsgate and the Jersey drama, of course, is always our last and final topic in the offseason.
As everybody loves to talk about.
Yeah, Nick, we'll kick it back over to you for who this episode is brought to us by.
Yeah, you know, this episode is brought to you by Manscaped, the Performance Package 4.0. Summer's here and you want to unveil your nice, sexy, hunky beach bod. You're in luck. Our friends at Manscaped just lost their fourth generation Performance Package, which includes the Lawnmower 4.0. You heard that right. Compliment your summer bod with a trim. Maybe get the little tuft you have here, the tuft you have down here. Leaders in male grooming, Manscaped. I love their boxers too. We got a nice pair of those. I wore them yesterday. Sun is shining. It's calling your name, fellas. Join the 2 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped and get ready for a hot boy summer by going to manscaped.com. Again, 20% off plus free shipping if you use the code LAFB20. You know, just the other day, I had a hot date, and I had to get ready. And this was before we were sponsored by Manscaped. And I went down there and just blood everywhere. And that is just no longer the case, thanks to the Manscaped 4.0. Yeah, and, you know, 20% off, free shipping. Just use the code LAFB20. It would really help us out. And, Dean, you want to take over our next sponsor, and then we can get started with some football talk?
Absolutely. Our next sponsor is BrewX. Brewery X is an independent craft brewery located in Anaheim where we could all eventually go hang out and drink on the LA Palma Beer Trail. Founded in 2018, the X and Brewery X represents and is all about crossing paths, coming to a juncture, and ending up where you want to be. Over 30 beers, 10 hard seltzers, curbside pickup 11 a.m. to 10 p.m., curbside pickup, or open every day 11 a.m. to midnight. That's BrewX. Let's transition into some football. Nick, you down?
Absolutely.
All right.
Couldn't be more ready.
The Flying Coach, most recent episode. I listened to it twice. Nick, you listened to it as well. Peter Schrager is the host of Flying Coach. He's joined by co-host Sean McVay with a guest appearance from Kyle Shanahan. There were a lot of inquiries to get Shanahan on the phone. McVay was able to do it. And Shanahan was on for about an hour and a half. He discussed everything from his upbringing, the relationship, coaching experience with his dad, interviewing for the San Francisco job, his reaction to the Rams trading for Matthew Stafford.
Yeah, he talked about how the San Francisco job wasn't his like number one job. He wanted some other. He didn't say exactly what it was, but
yeah, he thought there were some other opportunities. And I didn't know if he was fully genuine about the Matt Stafford reaction.
I mean, maybe he was upset because he thinks Stafford's an upgrade over Jarrett, which could be his own personal taste, but I think the whole media tried to spin it like it was like, oh, we were in the market for Matt Stafford, we were so upset that the Rams took him, which I don't think it is the case, just straight up. Just based on how they've been running things, but you know, like, who's to say? It absolutely could have been. The way that I think about these things is not how these professionals think about it, because I'm just like, Jimmy G, I know he's injury prone, but he just took you to a Super Bowl. It's not like he played lights out, but he had a couple touchdowns in that game. And like, he was completely serviceable that whole time. But you know, they drafted the quarterback this year, so it's with McVay and with Shanahan, it's very much, if you don't produce this year, I don't care about what your resume says. It's right now. That's really what it's. What have you done for me lately?
Yeah, we're going to talk about how that Stafford situation unfolded and a little bit more about the 49ers. But if you haven't listened to this podcast yet, there's a lot of spoilers in here. So just a heads up. But I'm going to kick it off, Nick, by defending Golden Boy Sean McVay. And here's why. The Kyle Shanahan, Sean McVay.
Everybody defends him.
I know.
He doesn't need any more warriors.
He doesn't. But it's his former boss. He's 6 years older than Sean. So McVay got his NFL coaching start technically because of his grandfather, John McVay, longtime GM and five-time Super Bowl champion for the 49ers. He hired John and Jay Gruden's dad as an assistant coach at Dayton University when he was the athletic director there in the early 70s. So there's a longstanding relationship between the Grudens and the McVays. But when McVay got his professional coaching start, it was because of John Gruden. So same with Kyle Shanahan back in 2004. They both started the exact same time. So who didn't want to coach, you know, in that grouping at that time? I mean, Kyle Shanahan didn't want to group with his dad or coach with his dad. He talked about that multiple times. And McVay was an offensive assistant in Tampa for a year back in 2008. And then he went to go coach with John's brother, Jay, for the Florida Tuskers. Then he was brought in by the Shanahans in 2010. So Mike Shanahan was the head coach for the next 3 years, as we all know. But they had some really big names on that staff. It was Mike's son, Kyle, obviously had been named the offensive coordinator after studying every play in the world from John Gruden. And it's funny, if you go back and look at some of the personnel groupings that Gruden used in this past year, you could tell that he does use every play in the playbook. Matt LaFleur was the quarterback's coach, and McVay was the offensive assistant, and Jim Haslett was a defensive coordinator. So you have a mega squad right there. I mean, you put all that together now, and it's one of the best coaching staffs in the league. So that's a little bit about his foundation.
Yeah, you put all together, you know, on paper, it sounds amazing, but that doesn't always, you know, have perfect results. I mean, if you go back and look at that Washington team, it's not like they were, like, you know, outstanding. And I know it has more to do with just coaching, but, you know, results matter. You know, I'll die on that hill with everybody defending Matt Stafford like he's this amazing guy. Results matter. And it's not like he didn't have an amazing defense or, you know, really great weapons when he went to the playoffs back then.
No,
it's not like that Washington team, you know, didn't have a really good Kirk Cousins, you know, like it's probably in his prime.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there were a lot of young minds in that room, too. And, they you could tell they shot the shit and they were all learning from each other and they were all kind of stemming off of Shanahan's foundation as a head coach. But they all had their kind of new ways of thinking. So it is very much of a results based league, as we all know. And, you know, we'll talk about a little bit more with Stafford. But like I mentioned, that's what I feel like McVay owes to his foundation as a coach. It's his new ways of thinking, his core values, the way he treats players, the way he interacts with people. Everything is to the Shanahans and the Grudens because that was his upbringing. So, I mean, more specifically, Kyle Shanahan, who I mentioned was his boss for what, 3 whole years at that point. So McVay looks up to him. It's a brotherly type of relationship where he's a mentor and was a boss, but they have that type of brother relationship. So if you haven't listened to it yet, consider that before you tune in, because Sean McVay is really giddy and excited whenever Shanahan tells a story or something, and he's always willing to laugh, and it could be a little bit irritating.
We were talking about Killer Instinct yesterday in the group chat between me, you, and our dad. And I was just saying, dad's like, oh, we got a killer in Sean. Like, he couldn't be more of a Killer Instinct. And then he's on this podcast, just, you know, absolutely giddy, giggling the whole time, talking with somebody who beat him 4 times in the last 2 years. And then you go back at the Super Bowl and he's doing the same, like he cannot help himself, but just like word vomit nice things about Bill Belichick. So I don't know. He's a human being and Shanahan's his friend. And he obviously looks up to Belichick because he's a head coach. But do you want to hold him to that standard or do you want to hold him to a head coach standard where it's like, I don't like to see that. I don't want to see how happy he is. I mean, obviously it's his friend. I wish there was sometimes you just wish there was more like vigor and grit in some of these things. Cause you want to win and that matters, you know, it does. You have to bring that, that competitive spirit in everything that you do.
Yeah. I think there's two sides to it, right? One side where McVay just wants to be friends with the guy, you know, he wants to be able to talk to him in his off time. It's a friend to friend personal type of relationship. And then at the other side of it, you look at it, you know, what can McVay start to instill in his playbook and maybe become a little bit stronger as a head coach as he continues to go against Kyle Shanahan for years to come. You know, there, I think Kyle Shanahan always feels like he has a consistent edge over McVay. And if anybody knows Sean McVay, it's Kyle Shanahan and Matt LaFleur, right? Those are the guys that know him the best. So when it comes to game planning against him, you know exactly what to expect. But I think from the perspective of having a mentor at work, that's something that if you had a boss or a mentor that you highly respected, would you feel confident going head to head against that person? I know I personally, I know it's different from football to, you know, the professional world in business. But yeah, I think there's still some kind of blockage in your head where you're saying to yourself, they might have an edge over me.
Yeah. And I think that's just like human nature.
Yeah.
I just want to see. I don't want to see this.
Yeah.
You know, it's the off season and they're friends and you got to respect that just straight up. But I don't know. It's just as a fan, you want to take out the humanity in the situation because you don't want to, you know, see them being all pals. But, you know, it's essentially a colleague of his. You know,
It feels like, well, how much more do you think we would enjoy this if they were Super Bowl champions in 2018 and Kyle Shanahan was not the following year?
Well, no, you know? I mean, I wouldn't care then, you know, it's not like if we would have run 1-18 and they would have won 1-19, I would be totally okay with it. I would probably be a little upset, but so much of it comes back to that loss.
Completely different perspective, I think, if they win. And winning takes care of everything. But I know you mentioned the lack of killer instinct that Sean McVay may have when it comes to Kyle Shanahan. It's extremely valid. I really like your stance on this. But when he talks about specific plays and formations and how the play was executed and who scored the touchdown, right? He remembers everything from soup to nuts about what the 49ers have been able to do over the past couple of years.
Soup to nuts.
I've
never heard that.
It's a new one. It's actually probably not. But in big moments, soup to nuts. Big moments over the last few years, you know, where is Sean McVay?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he's a beautiful mind. You know what I mean? Like, that is no longer a topic of conversation that, like, I hear that all the time. Everybody loves to bring that up. He remembers exactly this, that, and that. And maybe it's like, you know, he studies it, or maybe it's like he's one of those people who just has, like, a photographic memory like that. But, yeah, you got to have more than that. That doesn't win you games exactly. It's good to know that stuff, but.
Yeah, none of that stuff matters when you're in a 3rd and 5 and you're in your own or you're in enemy territory and there's less than 3 minutes to go and you got to score in some form.
If you know what they're going to do and you still lose, then you still lost.
Right. Yeah, no. And
even if you call it, it's not sick.
Yeah, no, I know. There are situations probably within those games where maybe McVay feels like if I plug and play Stafford over Goff or if I would have just called this in this situation, you know, all that stuff probably consistently runs through his head.
You could argue that's the killer instinct in Sean, that it's like this guy wasn't good enough, so I'm going to get rid of him for somebody that could come in and make that play. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's the case. I think you could have, like, you know, showed the person that you were there with Jarrett, like, you know, grow with him, teach him.
I think he tried. I think the play that I'm referring to that I was just talking about, right, the second game where they played against the 49ers this past year, and they had an opportunity to put that game away. And I was going back and forth with Roberto Clemente, who has an encyclopedia of knowledge on the Rams. He's a great Twitter follow. But just when you look at that play, you could argue that it was a one-read play or Goff didn't fully go through his progressions or he had more time in the pocket. There are so many different things that open up. Fred Warner was showing blitz. Robert Woods cut open, right? And if it was a one-read Cooper Kupp go route, maybe you have a quarterback in that situation who can manipulate a defense or, you know, read through what's happening within that play and make an adjustment and go to a different receiver. Go through your progressions. It shouldn't be a one-read play on a 3rd and 5 when you're in enemy territory with an opportunity to win the game is my only point. So maybe, you know, game within the game that you're talking about with Sean McVay that I think he can
Then again, it's like, well, if you know Jarrett, then you should know to give, like, either, like, have him farther back or give him more time in that position. It's like you, like, adjust.
I mean, he did.
Also, he had like 2 seconds. I mean, he's not the guy that was going to scramble. So I don't know. That to me is points away from Killer Instinct, because it's like,
well, I think McVay is kind of in a struggle mentally with what plays he can call. You know, what
it's more to me, it's more of like a finger pointing, like, oh, it's been your fault. You're the reason why we haven't done it. Where it's like, I feel like if you're a Killer Instinct, you're probably one, the leader, and two, you know, taking the blame for everything in situations. And then we gradually saw
he did
throughout last year where he goes, our quarterback needs to take better care of the football. And that was like, was that after the Dolphins game?
Yep.
Or was it? Yeah. And it was like, okay, well, one, that's a good point. But two, we're seeing the relationship crumble here.
Yeah, you saw it. I mean, you really did see it crumble. I was trying to look. It really felt like after that 49ers game was when the relationship started to go downhill. You saw on the sidelines that there was some remarks that would go back and forth. The body language was really poor. The relationship was just starting to digress. And
you could say that there was no killer instinct in Jarrett, which is, I think, is also a fair argument.
Yeah.
You know, he was never billed as that guy.
I think McVay wanted right. And maybe the lack of killer instinct in Goff was off-putting for McVay. And then you have the opportunity, Brad Holmes and the Lions and Stafford make themselves available. And he feels like Stafford could potentially come in and instantly install his own methodologies, his own.
Well, I mean, like
in that playbook, right?
At this point, he better. You know what I mean? Yeah. Because of how you're marketing it, because of what the moves you made to get him and where he is in his career. Because otherwise we're throwing out 13 Wolford and we're marooned. So like my position on McVay has completely changed over this offseason. I used to be like you and most other Rams fans, where it's just like, in McVay we trust. He brought us out of the ashes when we were so bad. But this move is just so – it just rubs me the wrong way in so many different ways that I can't – like, I feel like I have to just not – like, anytime someone's like, oh, McVay, he's the guy. It's like, well, you better prove it this year, because he's really not giving himself any kind of liability.
Well, I think the mutual respect –
obviously there's respect. I mean,
no, I'm that goes without saying. The mutual respect for Stafford. You could hear it pouring through the airwaves when Kyle Shanahan was talking about him. And you go back to study him and you understand why McVay is so happy. He seems like everything's finally aligned. I think it's a good opportunity to transition over to the training camp preview, right? Because we talked about training camp, how it's going to be starting up in 2 weeks. Just in terms of what we could expect to see, I mean, we already talked a little bit about Goff Stafford here, but we're going to dig into the offense a little bit more. I expect, in terms of social media with the Rams, a ton of bombs, right? DeSean Jackson, Jacob Harris, Tutu Atwell, returning punts, right? All the flashy stuff.
You're saying social media is just going to show like
the money ball. Yeah, they show the highlights. Absolutely. But one thing that I want to take a look at as the offense continues to evolve is the opportunity to increase their explosive air yards per play. That's for certain. That's something Jordan Rodriguez just called out in one of her recent articles. Explosive air yards and an increased overall yardage per play puts Sean McVay in a much better position to succeed. And he doesn't have to be overly confident or overly concerned, right, with difficult downs and distances. And he has more versatility with what he could do on certain spots of the field. So he doesn't have to put together these really long 14, 15, 15 play drives where his quarterback's dinking and dunking down the field, right? Those are the things that drive a coach crazy, right? You want to be able to take the top off. You want to be able to increase your explosive air yards per play. And it's not something that they did well in terms of 2018.
Yeah.
The Rams deep pass percentage, which is passes that travel 15 yards or more in the air, was so much higher than it was in 2020. Well,
you know what I'm going to say, right? You know exactly what I'm going to say.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
Brandon Cooks.
Yeah, partially Brandon Cooks and Todd Gurley opened up that offense.
It's not like Jarrett didn't show that was something he was more than capable of. Yeah, but you took that guy away, and then it's all Jarrett's fault. I mean, Gurley as well. Gurley was huge, and in 2019 we saw how huge he was.
Yep.
In like impact wise, and Cooks, but
yeah,
they still don't really have that. So I DeSean, Tutu potentially, but like, that's not something that's going to come right away. You know what I mean? I doubt we'll see that immediately. I bet we'll see more of the same with that, with like the 15, dink and dunk kind of offense.
Yeah, I mean,
it's not like it didn't work. It worked pretty well last year, you know. Like
they
almost won the NFC Championship.
That offense wasn't explosive, which increases the
opportunity. No, it wasn't explosive.
They were ranked almost dead last in deep pass percentage in 2020. I mean, they just weren't taking that opportunity. It wasn't in the playbook. They weren't calling the play. I expect the offense as a whole, right? I expect them to take a step up in terms of yards per play in total. But I think what happened when teams kind of started to figure out what happened with Jared Goff, when they started to send pressure up the middle, Sean McVay's playbook became somewhat limited and predictable with the 11 personnel. We're going to dig into that in a second. But you saw an increased completion percentage from Goff on higher probability throws over the last couple of years. Can we agree on that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry. I was nodding my head, but I realized that there are going to be people who are just listening and not watching.
But you saw his air yards go down. You saw his turnovers stay relatively the same as they have been over the past 3 years. But it forces his receivers and tight ends to do a little bit more work, right? They have to make catches in traffic. They're forced to create yards after the catch in difficult situations. But now I feel like defenses with Matthew Stafford, I talked about mutual respect, are going to back the hell off the line of scrimmage and out of the box in fear that they're going to get beat. I mean, that's a real concern. You have somebody that's at least a threat to take the top off the defense with Tutu Atwell and DeSean Jackson, depending on how long DeSean Jackson stays healthy. But I have to agree. I mean, I wrote this here in the script. I think that Jared Goff's numbers would be better this year with their current receiving core, an upgrade at the tight end, upgrade at the receiver. But I feel like defensive backs respect the hell out of Stafford. And they know they're going to be able to get beat if they turn their head. And I don't know if they feel the same way with Goff under center.
No, I think besides the Cardinals, I mean, at least the Seahawks and the Niners figured out how to take him down. But then again, like, I thought the Patriots did too, and Goff put on a show that game. So,
well, I mean, they limited him extremely in that game. I think he threw the ball less than 25 times. That was a Cam Akers show. In that game, that was a well coached game.
I'm just remembering the Goff dive.
He did enough in that game. He
had two touchdowns.
But increased fumbles, interceptions, missed time throws, untimely sacks. It all started to feel like it was starting to become the normal Jared Goff. You saw from 2019 to 2020 how McVay tried to add layers to that offense. It was additional formations. We saw a friggin' wildcat in the divisional round. What the hell was that? Personnel groupings, it did work, right? But that's, you know, just trying to mess with the game plan. Different personnel groupings, pre-snap motion, misdirection, traps, blocking schemes, all this stuff I feel like played into their strengths for the most part. But at the same time, they gave the ball away 25 times, which is more than 24 teams in the entire league. And Goff was the leader in all of it. I know his turnover rate hasn't been that high over his career. But he went through a stretch of games last year, six starts. He had four passing touchdowns, six picks, five fumbles, and four lost fumbles.
No turnovers in the two playoff games he played this year.
Good point. Goff, 65 turnovers, though, since 2017, our second most behind Jameis Winston, who the Saints haven't even been able to trust to play over Taysom Hill. But at the same time, turning the ball over, with the way that Jared Goff does it, I think in certain situations is extremely irritating. But his numbers haven't been all that egregious, which I think plays to your argument, Nick. In 2018, he turned the ball over 17 times. Guess how many times he turned the ball over in 2020?
17.
17 times. And what did they do in 2018? They averaged over 30 points per game. They finished second in the league in offensive scoring.
Probably only has that one postseason turnover, too, in the Super Bowl.
We were young in this game, but we were talking about Goff as an MVP candidate right alongside of Todd Gurley. At that time, I remember sitting down and talking to you about it. And the Rams reached the Super Bowl. I mean, we can't forget what Todd Gurley did that season. He averaged over 5 yards per carry.
Yeah, healthy Gurley, healthy Cup, probably different game.
Completely different Super Bowl.
You know, you can't think like that.
I know, but you imagine not having a game plan for Cooper Kupp, as efficient he was the entire season. Todd Gurley scored 21 touchdowns that year. Just absurd. And their red zone efficiency was so much better when Todd Gurley had the rock, and it kept them from being one-dimensional. And then you talked about Brandon Cooks, Nick. He was one of those guys that I think in 2019, when the injury started to creep up, I started to get concerned about the longevity of that contract. And when he was cut, I think we were both a little bit worrisome, right? It was like Do we still have that guy who could take the top off? I know Dad was concerned at that point. Were you?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, because, yeah, all the same reasons that both of us were.
Yeah. I mean, when you talk about Cooks, he was really, really good. He played 16 games in that 2018 season, caught 80 balls for over 1,200 yards.
Could have just came down with two more.
I know. Oh, dude, you're killing me.
I know. I can't stop thinking about it right now.
You're killing me. The next year, his yards per target went way down. And he was battling injury, and he only racked up 500-plus receiving yards. And Gurley's yards per attempt went down to below 4.0, which is really poor. And we all knew he was dealing with injury battles. But fast forward to 2020, the Rams finished 23rd in offensive scoring, with Goff turning the ball over the same amount of times that he turned it over in 2018. Excuse me. And he made there was a great point that was made by Roberto Clemente, one of our great Twitter followers. And I want to make this extremely clear to all fans that I think McVay feels like right now he could have potentially solved the riddle. But a couple of years ago, even fast forward rewind to 2019, I feel like he felt like he put his offense in the position to be a top scoring offense again. But I don't know if he felt like Goff was the guy who could properly facilitate his new scheme. That's where the question is going to lie until the season starts, right?
Right.
So in 2020, the Rams actually had more net drives to work with than they did in 2018, the Super Bowl Rams, yet 16 fewer touchdowns and 10 fewer field goals. I mean, they're not in position to kick field goals, one, right? Because they're not moving the ball down the field with explosive air yards per play. And 16 fewer touchdowns, you got to have some of red zone efficiency. You got to have a Jacob Harris. You got to have a back that can get down and dirty. You got to have a sneak. You got to have a shovel pass in the playbook. You know, all those things. It gets concerning if it's not there.
Little jet sweep.
Yeah.
Little Robert Woods jet sweep. Yeah, I mean, but those, like, those started to become the things that people knew McVay for.
Yep.
You know, so like they don't become as spontaneous, and then they become regular. And as soon as that happens, and like who's like that was a huge part of that 2017, 2018 team. It was so new. And now you got all these guys coming in, and they run a similar scheme.
Yep. I mean, you hit the nail directly on the head. And
that's another reason why I'm kind of off on McVay, because it's like you are now thinking that like I solved my problem. I couldn't be more giddy about my quarterback, where it's like, well, maybe the problem wasn't just that. Maybe it's you kind of got figured out a little bit, man, and you're not really taking any of that blame.
I think that's what he wants to figure out. Right. So,
well, I guess this would help him figure out that dilemma with getting a new quarterback. But if it's in the same, you know, if the same thing happens, if they don't get the NFC championship this year, then what was it all for?
It's also kind of odd to know that he's untouchable and Goff was just trash. Right. I mean, when you really think of it that way, he had so much power to be able to make that decision so quickly.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
so, I know if I was the owners, I would be like, no, figure it out.
Everybody, you know what I mean? Everybody signed right off on it because of the
well, because that's the guy that they trust.
Yeah. And yeah, I guess you have to do that. We'll talk about the scheme change. This is super interesting. When he owned 11 personnel, I mean, that was the talk of the town. There were books that were being written about it. Jordan,
there's a podcast called 11 Personnel.
Yeah. Named the podcast 11 Personnel. I mean, there's no other team that ran 11 personnel more than the Rams did in 2018. 11 personnel in first down, 94%. Second down, 100%. A third down, 97%. You could imagine that it was fairly easy for Bill Belichick to game plan against them in the Super Bowl. Especially, and we talked about this on many, many podcasts in the past, when they lay out the blueprint like Detroit and Chicago did on how to beat them. And when that personnel grouping and that scheme change kind of started to shift was in 2019, when McVay figured 12 personnel, which is one running back, two tight ends, and two receivers, would better suit his personnel groupings and prevent defenses from dominating with that 6-1 front and zero coverage. So
adjust. That's another thing that McVay's bad at. He doesn't know when, or like he gets in his own head too much. Mm-hmm. And like halfway through the game and you're like, okay, it's halftime. Adjust. Like they have figured it out. Show us 12. You know what I mean? Like change it up. Which is something I think he's getting better at, honestly.
Yes.
But like that was the biggest thing about him is that like he was so stubborn with what he thought worked.
He changed. I mean, he did change.
He did. And that's good. That's points for him for that, because you do have to change.
And yeah,
in everything.
This past year was pretty crazy.
I was gonna say this is a crazy stat. In 2020, McVay dipped to 65% of 11 personnel on first down, 79% on second down, and 72% on third down, which is still an astronomical amount. But it's also right near the league average.
Yeah.
So like in retrospect, it's not that crazy. They mixed in 350 plays out of 12 personnel last year, which is nearly a third of McVay's play calls. They also mixed in a little bit of 13 personnel, which is three tight end set. And for what it's worth, 11 personnel is still the most popular personnel grouping just in all of football. So
It is. I mean, you have to take some of that in consideration, too, is that's kind of the foundation is, the 11 personnel set. It's pretty comforting, I guess, for offenses to run out of that formation. And, a lot of successful plays over the last couple of years. And that's how the league moves. But you take into consideration for McVay's pre-snap movement and all the misdirection, for that to succeed, he needs to have his offenses in specific personnel groupings to do so.
Yes, yes.
He has to be able to switch it up enough so that defenses like the 49ers, like the Green Bay Packers, aren't able to make that adjustment.
Yes.
Right? And then you throw in a wildcat or whatever. But it's just not enough.
But to McVay's point, all that misdirection – comes into play and works beautifully when you run the same formation.
Yeah.
It's like you're not throwing out a bunch of different stuff. You're doing the same thing, but right before it's about to start, tossing the smoke screen, and then you really don't know what's going to happen,
which is
cool.
Yeah. You know, you're right. I've been trying to find points to disagree with you this whole episode, but I that's where all of the confusion comes, right? You're trying to follow the guy that's running across your screen, running across the field, and all of a sudden the ball snapped in the other direction, and you have linebackers and defense tackles and edge rushers all trailing in one direction, and then all of a sudden the ball's on the other side of the field. It's fascinating what he's done over the last couple of years. But again, you have to be able to evolve, and I think he feels like he has the guy to be able to do that. He did comment on the podcast, 80% of turnovers come on passing downs. So he's very aware of that. What is strange is, though, when you know that type of information and you're down the stretch with Jared Goff, you just put out a template on how to destroy the New England Patriots, right? A run-heavy attack in week 13. They were playing to their strengths. Goff only threw the ball 25 times, turned it over once, and Cam Akers was really starting to dominate. Now he's being projected as a running back one in fantasy. He's going to have a good year this year. But that's not a sustainable model to win games over a long period of time, right? That game where they in the divisional round where they dominated the Cowboys, right? Was that a sustainable model? No, but they were playing to their strengths and they knew what the Cowboys defense was capable of.
And they had CJ on top of their CJ.
They had CJ.
And that's what they tried to do in the Saints game. But CJ and Gurley had like a horrible turnover very early on. And CJ, I think, got like maybe like 8 yards that whole game or something like that. It was something ridiculous, or maybe it was like 17. But he was like, we still got the W. But yeah, I mean, like, that's what they tried to do. That was a good, piece of adjustment. But you're right. It's not sustainable. It's not something that you can have all,
Yeah, it's kind of thing.
Put your hat on. But every now and then you get, one of these amazing backs and you're like, oh, this is just our whole team.
I think what the Rams did really well last year,
Derrick Henry.
They were able to play opponents' weaknesses really well. The defense was incredibly tough, right? The different type of groupings that they ran out with their defensive backs, mixing Jalen Ramsey in the nickel and rotating defensive backs and, young, fast, hybrid linebackers and Aaron Donald, of course. That defense was very revolutionary, which is why Brandon Staley got a head coaching job. So they were playing to opponents' weaknesses that whole season. But to be a Super Bowl caliber team, you have to be able to play to the opponent weaknesses and then also be able to overcome a situation where you're getting outcoached, right? You have to have a player that can take you over the top if, you fall behind 28-3 in a Super Bowl, right? You need somebody that has that type of killer instinct and that winning mentality to be able to take you over the top. So,
I wonder how mad Shanahan gets when you bring up that Falcons Super Bowl. Do you think he gets more mad about the Falcons Super Bowl or the
Falcons
Niners?
The Falcons, because the narrative is that he just couldn't stop throwing the ball. And if you listen to the podcast, he talks about how he just felt like Julio Jones was completely unstoppable in that game. And he was like, no, we want to get the ball. We want to go. You know, we don't want to chew a ton of time off the clock. We want to be able to win this game and put it away. And he said he was just his blood was boiling when Brady was on the field, because it was just play after play. It was just dominating the defense.
And like the lucky breaks that they got, that Edelman catch is just like probably is like burned in his retina.
And he's
like, it's an amazing defensive play. The ball is batted.
Yep. And there was a play that actually broke for a first down, similar to what happened in that Rams game where they in the Super Bowl, where they call that hold and just killed us on that drive where Gurley had his first big run of the Super Bowl. But a very similar play where they called a hold in a similar situation obviously went in the Patriots' favor. And he said that should be the narrative of the game, was that holding call, like it is in the NFC.
Is that what he said? No way is that what he said.
Go back and listen to the episode. Very, I would say that's a carbon copy.
You can't say that.
Not that he thinks it should be the narrative, but there should be more talks about what happened outside of the box score of 20.
Loser. Spoken like a loser, man.
And there's a lot of stuff.
You can't be the guy that lost and been like, oh, yeah, but, you know, if the dice were rolled this way, you know what I mean?
Captain Hindsight, I know. But I just want to be honest with all of our listeners, with you, with anybody else that watches the Rams. There's no offense as painful to watch as Sean McVay's offense when it's been figured out. So if the offense, if the offense for whatever reason does become figured out this season, we have to be reliant on the quarterback to be able to pull us out of that shit. But obviously overall McVay hopes that under Stafford, the offense that was ranked 22nd overall in total offense last year, and 26 in passing touchdowns and 19th in red zone touchdowns, is going to drastically improve. That is not a Sean McVay offense. Those are not numbers that a Sean McVay offense puts up.
Okay. No, that was his offense. And those are the numbers that he put up. So like, how is that not a Sean McVay offense?
Because he put out a sample size of 2.5 years of really great offense. And you're going to judge it off of.
Yeah. Off of one of his years. By his standards, that's the year you should judge him on, because it was the most recent. It was the last one. So, like, it's that you can't double standard it like that.
You know what I mean?
Like, that was his offense.
Like,
that's what he did.
What portion
he underperformed? Yes, but so did the whole team.
What portion of you and what portion of the fan base feels like
I have to be the minority?
No. You're not. I don't think you are. But what part of the fan base do you feel like McVay probably felt like he had to play 100% mistake-free football and was micromanaging the game within the game? And when Jared would make a mistake, it would compound into more frustration and questionable play calling and talk behind each other's backs. That, to me, in a nutshell, felt like what happened.
Yeah.
You know, having to play perfect football, having to call.
Well, no, I mean, play. it's like the McVay legacy. And I, you know, some people don't like, can't take that, that form of like coaching.
Yeah.
Like that, like old school, like I'm going to fucking, I'm sorry. Pardon me. I am going to scream at you and like make this 100% your fault. And like, you know, and whether that may be the case or not, some people just aren't wired that way.
Right.
And no, I think that just, you know, kind of blew up and became a whole separate issue outside of the actual play of the game. And you know what? Probably made the play worse. I would say that as well.
Well, especially
when you had somebody that was, you know, described as so robotic and robust as Goff, where like when he messed up, it was like, okay, like
yeah,
I messed up, but I'm back in it. Like I'm still here. I'm ready.
Those are two things I loved about Jared Goff was he could make a mistake and you felt like it never happened to him, and he was never hurt. He was never off the field besides the one thumb injury when Wolford got a taste. But I want to mention activation of eligibles. Is a phrase that Jordan mentioned in one of her recent articles. It's a phrase you're going to hear a lot this year. Probably going to drive you crazy. But it's all about Stafford's ability to manipulate coverage and move out of the pocket and work efficiently through his progressions in order to widely distribute the ball, which is what I think Matt Stafford is in his core. But it also speaks to
that
the Rams feel like they've added layers to their passing game, both horizontally and vertically.
Yes.
So I mean, I'm pretty excited that the team feels like they have a new identity. I think that's one thing that I know maybe it's not the identity that you're looking for, but it starts with the quarterback. And you can't fail to mention that some of the players on this roster are certainly going to get a lot of attention outside Matt Stafford that are newcomers. So I think partially you could be excited for that. I don't know if you're against that, but I think the
new
is here.
There is plenty room for excitement. It's just the expectations now have become so high. So I'm just like a little worried. I mean, I'm more excited, honestly. And I know this is an unpopular opinion, but we had such an amazing defense last year. I am just with the young talent and with Aaron Donald hopefully being like reaching like a like an apex mode. I mean, he's been unstoppable for years now.
He's still in his apex. Yeah.
So like, as flashy and showboaty as this offense wants to be, it'll get you nowhere if you don't have the solid defense like we had last year. So
I know. Yeah. The defense is going to be something that we're going to have to break down in a separate episode, but just because it was so great last year, that's the issue that we had in 2019. Remember, we were talking about champagne problems and they added Eric Weddle and Clay Matthews and everything's going to be great. And we didn't have anything to talk about.
Weddle, don't even get me started on that guy. McVay's still out here saying, oh, yeah, he's definitely one of the people that I could foresee being a coach in my lifetime. And it's like, oh, God, that he was so horrible for us.
I know. I heard Eric Weddle's name on the podcast alongside.
Right? Yeah. It's like
McVay getting all giddy with Shanahan. I'm like, dude, you're going to kill me.
Like, who did Weddle, you know, what amazingness did, like, who? I'm not going to say what I want to say.
It was just a bad experience with Eric Weddle. But during training camp, I know we talked about the Rams social media showing highlights and stuff. But of course, there are some big names that I really want to take a look at. Tutu Atwell, of course, returning punts, potentially rotating in the slot, maybe as a third receiver.
Jacob returning.
I know you're nervous. I would be too.
Rookie punt returner. Love the sound of that. It's God. Our special teams must do better next year.
They were so bad last year.
They were maybe the worst special teams in the league.
I think they were. They were. I think they were last or second to last.
Yeah, they were at the absolute bottom.
Yeah, they were terrible. And we called it out every single time they made a mistake. Jacob Harris is a name that nobody could stop talking about. The Rams put out an article on him today. He's only been in shorts and a helmet, and they're blown away by him. I would like to see him in pads and in contact. Austin Corbett, Bobby Evans, Joe Noteboom. The way that offensive line is starting to evolve, I think the athleticism, if you watch Baldy's most recent tweet, he talks about the crossover effect and how these offensive linemen are so much more athletic and can really get that first step down. And it drives defensive lines crazy, and it creates a lot of lane for running backs to merge through. And I'm interested to see how the offensive line progresses, especially as we lose Aaron Cromer, but his son Zach is still there. David Long, I think as he potentially rotates into the nickel role, takes over for Troy Hill. Terrell Burgess, obviously a safety they drafted last year, see what his impact is. Same with Taylor Rapp, see if they're going to be vocal leaders on that defense. And then Ernest Jones, the rookie linebacker that they drafted. Can he come in? Can he win the Mike linebacker position? Going to be really interesting to see. So that's kind of what I'm taking a look at. There's some other stuff. I think, you know, the way that the running back group is built.
How much Henderson gets on the field.
How much Henderson is able to be, is Cam Akers a three down back? Is he able to improve in pass pro? Do they need more at that position? Do they need more on the offensive line?
How, you know, it's just like McVay's got so many toys now. Like I don't even know what else I can say. You know what I mean? It's like you have to, like you have everything that you want now. Henderson is more than capable of being like a great back in this league, I believe. Obviously Cam is too. So give us 2018, you know?
Yeah, but can Cam Akers carry the load throughout a 17-game season?
I don't think he has to because we have other great good backs. Still have Xavier, right?
Yep, we do. I haven't seen a ton of him, but they talk about him, that they like him. But I don't know if they're going to be able to play that same level of smash-mouth football that they played back in 2018. John Sullivan was a guy that they talked about at the center position that McVay talked about in the podcast that he just loved, even as a coach, as a player. Can Austin Corbett, who put out a pretty good tape last year, can he come in and play really well at center? Should they have drafted a center? So the whole offensive line, we're going to continue to monitor. I think the defensive backs, real quick, we'll talk about the defense and Ernest Jones. David Long, Dante Dion, Terrell Burgess, Taylor Rapp, they all have really, really solid opportunities to carve out their own role on this defense. It's going to be interesting to see who wins those jobs. Who wins the nickel job? Is it Long or is it Dion? Does Robert Rochelle, the rookie, rotate in and take some reps behind Jalen Ramsey? And how bad is John Johnson the third? You know, how bad is that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want anybody. I want Ramsey on the field all the time. I this may be a hot take, but I don't think we're going to see a lot of rap.
No, we might not. No.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to make the cut. I mean, maybe special teams guy, but
I think they like him in that hybrid linebacker type role where he can go in and out of the box and maybe drop into coverage. But he's a weird size. He's like kind of a strong safety, but he could play a little bit of linebacker, and he's a good tackler, but not really. It's a weird player.
Yeah. He's like more of like an Iron Man than he is like a good football player.
He's tough to fit into your lineup, that's for sure. Maybe they rotate him in specific sub packages.
Yeah,
I mentioned Ernest Jones. I haven't been impressed with the Mike linebacker position since Corey Littleton, and I think his presence was felt. I know Jake Ellenbogen called that out multiple times. We're not going to be able to replace Littleton. He was right. And one of the things that I want to see is that Mike linebacker position start to go into the direction where we're moving in the top 15, 10 in terms of performance. You're not going to get that out of Kenny Young or who's the other guy, Troy Reader. But can Micah Kizer step in? You know, who's going to be the leader of that group? Who's going to be the voice of the defense in the linebacker group? So I think all that stuff it remains to be seen. But I do like Ernest Jones' potential to be able to step into that role. All right, Nick, let's talk about the Kurt Warner movie.
Okay.
Oh, the lights are on.
Right. Yeah, no, I thought it was cool that you and I had like a dark light aesthetic, but the sun has parted ways in California now, and the sun is down, so I figured I'd turn on my my lamp.
Sun's going
but,
down.
But yes, this Kurt Warner movie, is it corny as hell? Absolutely. Am I going to see it? Absolutely. It looks like an amazing airplane movie. I was like, is that mean? But, you know, I like, how come we didn't see any clips of like them wearing the white jerseys? Because like, wouldn't you show the Super Bowl?
The Super Bowl.
They got Dick Vermeil as the dude from like the Cheaper by the Dozen ripoff movie.
Dennis Quaid. You got to remember the Dennis Quaid.
Dennis Quaid.
Dick Vermeil is Dennis Quaid. I judge football movies on two things. One, how the quarterback holds the football. And two, how he throws it.
How does Zach LaVine look to you?
He looks like, I don't even know if I trust him, like a beach football quarterback.
He looks like he looks like an actor.
I mean, he looks like you catch a couple of passes from him in the parking lot. Outside of that, I'm pretty concerned. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I know Zach LaVine is kind of a religious guy, and obviously Kurt Warner is also a very religious guy. So we may have like a little something of like, it may be that kind of movie. It may be something that you watch in your theology class when your teacher goes to sleep, if you're in a like, you know, Catholic high school.
We're really underselling this thing.
I guess we are. I mean, but you know what? It's an underdog movie. So we should undersell it. Hopefully it blows our socks away. We will rally behind this movie and we will watch a good film. Hopefully.
That's a hell of a quote. That this movie, when I first saw the trailer, I was like, this is going to be great. You know, this is the movie that was made for me. You know what I mean?
I mean, it is. Kurt Warner has one of those amazing stories that like,
he does.
You know where this movie will fit right in? It's going to fit right next in. Invincible's right here. Right here. You're going to get that Kurt Warner movie. And you know what? This is a way cooler story, TBH, because Kurt Warner actually led a team to a Super Bowl. No offense to that story or anything. Right. But.
Well, I mean, as you know, Vince Papale was a decent player. He's a special teams player, you know, but his story was also amazing, too. But
that, like, feel good, like, you know, you can do anything if you try. And it seemed like it almost, and look, this is another undersell, but it looked like an SNL trailer. Like, show clips of him in the grocery store, like, holding, like a piece of bread, like he's going to throw it like a football.
Remember in Little Giants with the toilet paper?
Toilet paper, yeah.
That's what I wanted to see. That's what I wanted to say.
All right. Well, you know, that movie, we're going to see it. I'm sure we'll talk about it later once it gets sooner. And hopefully it comes out in December. So hopefully the Rams are doing well and we can all go enjoy that movie together.
Well, could you imagine they're like about to make a playoff run? That movie comes out, they win the Super Bowl the same year, and I go to heaven.
So you would die? You would die in that scenario?
All right, hold on.
So this must be addressed because I've been saying some stuff and now some other stuff's going on. I don't know what's up with these uniforms anymore. From what I heard from my inside source is that they are yellow. But when we were at SoFi, I asked one of the employees there, and they said the next ones is coming out are white. So, my information comes from somebody who works directly for the Rams. So you got to think that he would know more than the clerk at SoFi, but who's to say? The jersey that we saw, Cam DeSilva tweets it, shows exactly what it is, and people still think it's the real jersey. And to me, it makes zero sense to have a white if you have bone. So white and bone are two of our primary colors. Like that, to me, that makes zero sense. I don't see those as being one of the jerseys. And I think they're trying to move more towards Soul and separate themselves from any kind of St. Louis history. And that is, that white jersey, that iconic Super Bowl Kurt Warner jersey, that's the most St. Louis jersey I think there is, besides maybe like the navy blue.
Well, the thing is, they won in those jerseys, but that was
exactly St. Louis.
Technically a Los Angeles Rams jersey.
Right. But like, history shows that that's the St. Louis Rams Super Bowl victory those jerseys. So I also personally think the yellow would be super cool. I mean, and also, you talked about this. The Rams are saying that's not it. But they said the exact same thing about that draft hat, and that was the exact draft hat. So I don't trust them. The whole thing, I just hate. Regardless of what these jerseys are, the Rams PR team must do better. They have dropped the ball so many times throughout the last 3 years. It is absurd. I know like jerseys and stuff like this isn't that big of a deal in the grand scheme of things, but Kevin Demoff, you got to do better in this regard because we wear it, the players wear it. It's something, it's a badge of honor. Like I think you just have to be better at this.
That's my take. I totally agree.
And it sounds like I'm complaining, but I'm just,
No, it doesn't. I think my gut tells me that those white jerseys with the yellow on the sleeves are very real. And according to a recent report from sportslogos.net, it will be the white jerseys that you saw on Tutu Atwell's Instagram that will be added to the repertoire. What's interesting is we had Holden went out and did this on his own. So also hashtag verify Holden if you haven't tweeted that yet. But he actually called the memorabilia company that hosted Tutu, and they said that the uniforms were specifically made for the event, which Cam also came out and said the same thing. Meanwhile, sportslogos.net refutes this point by saying that the Rams have denied legitimate leaks in the past, i.e. the draft hat, as you mentioned. So keep in mind, the Rams lie all the time. The PR team, I think, should be better about this. But they said the jerseys are going to come out before training camp, and training camp's 2 weeks away. So I think at any moment, we're going to see some strange social media.
I just don't know how you can do this same thing twice.
I hope they don't.
I don't know how you do it twice. I really don't. Like, you got such a bad reception from the hat and you release it anyway. And you get such a bad reception from this shirt and you're going to release it anyway. Hopefully it's not it.
Weirdly enough, some people did like that look. I wasn't a fan of it, but
I couldn't like it less.
But one fan actually pointed out that the Chiefs are selling a black jersey.
Which they would
never ever wear. So I think we should just stick to our guns and say they're going to be yellow. I think your source is extremely reliable and is connected to the Rams. And we haven't seen any recent TikToks or Twitter posts or anything outside of Tutu Atwell's story that would indicate that the Rams are going with the white look. I think it would clash with the bone. And the Rams
tried to make a jersey with gray pants.
They tried to make a statement last year with the bone color replacing the white. That was their original take on the white. So
and we love that. That's the best thing that they've done so far. And this would just poo-poo all over that.
It was cool that there was a portion of the Ram logo that had the bone color, right? It was like the color of the ear on the Ram, which is the reason why they were able to pull that bone. You know, it's just weird, very weird, but definitely interesting. So the story is always fun to follow. Cool also, maybe. But I just don't want them to be so clumsy to leak it in that way, right? Tutu Atwell's already leaked the playbook. He's leaking the jerseys. Bad start, Uncle Tutu.
Yeah. Somebody's got to come get that kid.
Yeah, somebody come get him.
But
all right.
Thank you, Rams Nation, for listening to this podcast, as always.
I think, Nick, we dug into the origin of Sean McVay, which was long overdue for us, right? We wanted to know what the hell made him Sean McVay, and that podcast brought a lot of good clarity. Then you pair that with everything else that we talked about from the offense, the way that the scheme is changing, some players that we expect to step up in training camp. There is so much to be excited about with this team. And then you layer on another jersey. So there's always going to be stuff for us to talk about with this team. So whatever you guys want to hear about, tweet at us, send us a DM.
Can't wait to start doing these weekly again for you guys when the season starts in preseason. Couldn't be happier to do this with you, Dean.
Yeah, good stuff, man. All right, cool. All right, well, we'll talk to you guys soon.
Yeah, and one more time, let me just say, free shipping, Manscaped, 20% off, code LAFB20.
The boxers are legit.
The boxers are very legit. And Brewery X, thank you also for sponsoring. You guys are great. Looking forward to more Rams talk throughout the year, brother.
Awesome. Thanks, brother.